Thank you, Maureen. I'm happy to be here with you. I think the important thing is that our mind is peaceful. We can't control the external world so much and make it peaceful, but we can make our minds peaceful. And so I think that's where spiritual practice, and in particular meditation, is very important, because it helps us pacify our mind, so that instead of creating many stories and going out on, you know, all sorts of limbs and getting worried and anxious, we just stay in a calm, kind attitude. Because you look at all the other people in the cars, you know, you're sitting there parked on the highway, and you look around and you think, all those people want to be happy and not suffer, just like I want to be happy and not suffer. And you really think about that while you're sitting in the car. And it brings a feeling of connection to all of those other people. It brings a feeling of compassion for them, because they're in the same situation as you are, and you understand what their situation is like. And so in that way, your mind is peaceful, and you're connected to all those people instead of vying with them for the next 2 feet, you know, to pull your car ahead. Oh, you would see somebody who looked pretty much like all the young women did in the 60s and early 70s, wearing patched jeans, a peasant blouse, long hair, you know, ears pierced with earrings, no makeup, you know, just like that. That's what you would have seen. I thought I was happy. It wasn't until I really began to look deeply in my life that I realized that happiness is more than having what society thinks should make you happy. I was, in my first years in college, I got quite depressed, because I was wondering, what's the meaning of my life? And why am I here on earth? And I couldn't find anyone whose explanation made any sense to me. I think was depressed because, you know, most people in their late teens, early 20s, all you want is somebody to love you. And at least with my generation, you know, we weren't so close with our parents, and you know, so we were wondering, you know, who loves me, and all this kind of stuff. So yeah, in those years I wasn't so happy. Then once I started working, I think I got happier, because I was working in education, and I found that useful. And I also traveled a lot, and I found that wonderful, because I really learned so much from traveling abroad. Well, I had been in Nepal trekking and seen Buddhist images and things like that, which I thought were kind of cool, but I didn't understand it very much, but there was some kind of connection. When I got back to Los Angeles, and I was in grad school and teaching in the public schools, I saw a flyer for a Buddhist meditation retreat. And so as a teacher, I wasn't working in the summer, I went to the retreat. And it was being taught by two Tibetan lamas. Lama in Tibetan means a spiritual mentor, a spiritual teacher. And so I attended that course, and what they said made a lot of sense to me. When I practiced it, it really helped me. And so that was my first encounter with Buddhism. I remember the first time I tried to meditate, which was totally hilarious. I had no idea what meditation was. I went to this retreat, and the teachers were a little bit late, so there was somebody leading the session, and he said, let's just meditate until the teachers arrive. And I had no idea what meditation was. And I had seen pictures of people rolling their eyes back in their head and sitting in some funny position. So I didn't want to look like I didn't know what I was doing, even though I didn't know what I was doing. And so I sat like that. And thank goodness it wasn't for too long, because rolling your eyes back in your head gives you a headache. But it was after that, then in the course, then they taught us how to meditate. And then, you know, when I had proper instructions and I knew what I was supposed to be doing, then it became much easier. That was actually within a few weeks of going to this retreat. The retreat was for 3 weeks, and then I did a private retreat with a few friends for a week after that. And I knew then that, wow, this is something really important, and I have to follow up with it. Okay, well, first, you know, it was the process of becoming a Buddhist. Like I said before, because it made sense to me when I thought about it using reason and logic, and also when I practiced it, I found it really helpful. And as I practiced and learned more and more, just the importance of having a spiritual tradition and of dedicating yourself to that became so evident to me that I thought, you know, I just want to dedicate my whole life to this, because this is what is really meaningful in my life. And so at that time, that's when I went in and requested my teacher to become a nun. After meeting the Dharma in the U.S., then we went to their monastery in Nepal. And so, you know, he was just as taken with the Dharma, with the Buddha's teachings, as I was. And so he understood, one part of his mind understood why I wanted to become a nun. The other part of his mind was going, oh, my wife, oh, no. But he was really good. He didn't guilt trip me. He didn't make a scene. He accepted it, even though it was very difficult for him. Well, clearly the marriage separated, we got divorced. My mother introduced him to somebody else. They got married and have 3 children. And we're all still friends. Oh, my parents did not like it at all. I did very well in college. They wanted me to go on to graduate school and, you know, get a degree, get a really high-paying job, be very successful, have my 2.5 children, you know, everything. Go on cruises with the family for vacation. And, you know, they got a daughter who wasn't interested in that. They got me instead. So it was hard for them to adjust to, you know, how I wanted to live my life and what made me happy. And so for many years, we weren't in touch. They did not want to talk to me. I kept writing them letters every month, you know, because I knew that if they didn't hear from me, they would worry. So I tried to be a good daughter and do what I could, you know, and so I wrote to them all the time, and they didn't answer. Eventually, when I lived many years outside of the States, when I came back to live in the States, we never formally sat down and discussed it. But just, you know, once I lived here, I would call them, you know, from time to time. We kept in touch. And so gradually, the whole thing healed over. They would still make comments to me about, kind of, how can somebody intelligent like you believe in this? But then from my brother and sister told me that when I wasn't there, they would say, oh, my daughter's doing this, and she gets invited places to give Buddhist teachings, and she writes books. And so to their friends, all of a sudden, then they were very proud of me. But to me, you know, not always so. But that was only after I would say about my being a nun 10 years. The first 10 years they were just very unhappy, and I don't think they talked about it much with other people, or only their close friends. Yeah, first of all, not killing, and so obviously not killing human beings, but also animals and insects. And then not stealing, not taking what hasn't been freely given to us, so respecting other people's property. And then we're celibate, which is very clear, and not to lie, especially lying about spiritual attainments. We don't take intoxicants. We don't sing, dance, and play music unless it has a, you know, religious chanting and things like that. That's okay, but regular singing we don't do. What else? We wear our robes and shave our head and, you know, try and spend our time cultivating compassion and wisdom. And the thing is, there's two things. First of all, when you listen to music, then when you sit down to meditate, all the tunes are going on in your head. And that becomes a distraction in your meditation. A second reason is that when we listen to music or dance, we often in the back of our mind have the motivation of attracting attention to ourselves, making ourselves attractive, making people look at us. So that's another reason that we don't do it. You know, for the first couple of years of ordination, when I would see a couple walking down the street hand in hand or his arm around her, I would go, oh, I remember how good that felt. But then I would also remember, that's not all marriage is, you know. Marriage is a lot more. And all the other things about marriage, you know, were not what attracted me, and they became interferences to my spiritual path. As a fully ordained nun, we have 348 precepts that we follow. 48, yes. So, well, the thing is, they take the basic ones that I outlined before and break them down into more specific situations. So that's basically what's happening, you know. And so many more about speech, about not speaking harshly to others, not slandering them, not accusing them without foundation. So a lot more specific things. I think a lot of them are common sense things, and I wouldn't say they're commandments. In Buddhism, we don't even call them vows usually, or commandments. We say they're precepts. In other words, they're things to train our mind in. So we see them as ways to train our mind in virtue. Ways to train our mind to not do the things that anyway we don't really want to do. So there's a couple of reasons. One is it symbolizes giving up ignorance, anger, and attachment, which we call the three poisonous attitudes that kind of ruin our life and ruin our relationships with others. So that's one reason. A second reason is usually when you don't have any hair, you're not so attractive. So it definitely makes it easier to be celibate. It sends a message to anybody who might be interested in you that, no, I'm not available. And, you know, it's, it strikes at the attitude within us that wants to be attractive so that people will notice us, so that people will like us. And especially in this culture right now, where so much emphasis is put on external beauty, and you've got to look a certain way to attract a person, and you've got to dress a certain way to have a certain kind of job. You know, and you've got to have beautiful hair. I mean, look at all the what's put on top of Hillary Clinton because she's a woman. So we're just saying, hey, that isn't important in life. And if people are going to like me, it's because I have a good heart, not because I have a beautiful appearance. We're quite busy, actually. We don't just sit around and do nothing. So most of us are up before 5 a.m. Then we have common meditation at 5:30, 5:30 to 7. 7:30 is breakfast. 8:15 we have a stand-up meeting, a kind of a check-in meeting for the day. And then we all go and do our various, we call it offering service. That's what other people call work, but we find that using a different vocabulary puts a different slant on it. So we offer service to the community and to society. Then we have lunch. Before lunch, we have some prayers. After lunch, we also do some chanting. Then the lunch is at noon, then until 2 o'clock we have a break. Then we do more offering service, and then at 4:30 we usually have teachings or we have study time. That goes until 6 when we have medicine meal. And then 7 o'clock is meditation again until 8:15. And after that, we have private time. Most people either study or do more meditation then. The idea is, because in the time of the Buddha, the monastics went on pindapat. In other words, they went on alms round in the town and accepted food that was given to them by the villagers. And although we don't do that now in modern society so much, at the time of the Buddha, they did that. And if people went out in the evening, sometimes the villagers were frightened because it was dark. Sometimes the monastics trip and fell in the cesspools. It wasn't so good. And it was also quite inconvenient for the villagers having people come more than once a day. And so the Buddha made a precept that we don't eat in the evening. However, if you have health concerns, if you're doing manual labor, if there's difficulties, in terms of your body energy, if you don't eat in the evening, then it's permissible to eat. But we call it medicine meal because we look at the food not as something to enjoy, but as medicine that nourishes our body and keeps it alive and healthy so that we can practice. No. It's usually leftovers that we reheat. We don't buy any food ourselves. We eat only food that is brought to us. So people donate the food and then we cook it here. We have a small garden. But, we live where it's cold, so yeah. Yeah, he's really quite amazing. The first time I ever met him I didn't meet him personally. I attended a teaching. There were thousands and thousands of people at the teaching. And the teaching was all in Tibetan with no translation. So there was only afterwards in the evening somebody gave us a summary of what he said. So this was in the old, back in the 70s. And so I didn't really understand very much at that time who the Dalai Lama was because I didn't understand what he was teaching in English and all. But then over time, I began to attend teachings where there were translations. And also before he won the Nobel Peace Prize, it was easier to see him. And so I remember going to visit him once, maybe twice before then, and meeting him personally and asking him some questions. And he's quite amazing, because he always says, I'm just a simple Buddhist monk, nothing more, and he does what he tells other people to do, which is, he sees himself as equal to everybody, he is friendly to everybody, he sees people as his friends, and reaches out to them. He has a great sense of humor, but also he can be very stern when need be. You know, when something needs correcting or whatever, he just says it quite directly. What we did is I would come and we would have a series of interviews for about a week and work together morning and afternoon. And I would ask him questions and then, you know, record all of that. And then I would go back and, you know, edit it and, you know, put it into good English and mix it in with teachings that he had given on other occasions. But it was quite wonderful because it was him and me and a translator, and then he would usually invite sometimes one his younger brother who would come, and sometimes two or maybe three geshis. Geshis are like people who have PhD in Buddhism from the monasteries. And so I would ask a question, and then he would talk about it with the translator, with the geshis, and get into this lively debate, and then, you know, they would kind of give me the gist of it afterwards. So it was really amazing to see. You could tell His Holiness is, I mean, the depth of his wisdom and his knowledge and his questioning and investigation. He doesn't just take things as, well, Buddha said this, so it's true. He really analyzes and investigates until he understands it. And also you can see in his teachings when he you know, gives public teachings, he will teach about some very deep philosophical topic, and then 2 minutes later, he'll crack a joke, and then he'll talk about something that everybody in the audience can understand, and then he'll go back into some deep philosophy. So he weaves things in and out, and you know, he doesn't expect everybody to understand everything all at once, which of course none of us do, but that's completely all right. We all get something out of the teachings. And I remember one time watching a reporter, I think it was somebody from the LA Times, interview him and said, you know, this is Your Holiness, the Dalai Lama, you've been a refugee since you were 24 years old. You haven't been allowed to go back to your country. There's been genocide in Tibet. There's been environmental destruction in Tibet. How come you aren't angry? How come you aren't depressed? And, you know, the reporter gave His Holiness a total lead-in to really rail against the Chinese communist occupation of Tibet. His Holiness did not go that way. You know, she said, how come you're not angry? And he said, what good does anger do? If I'm angry, I wouldn't be able to enjoy my food. I wouldn't sleep well. It wouldn't help the problem at all. Anger has no use whatsoever. And the reporter is sitting there with her mouth wide open because nobody has ever answered a question like that before. Yeah. And, you know, so he was, you can see by his life that even in the face of destruction and disaster and pain, there's the opportunity to be happy and be joyful and to make your life meaningful. I remember one time I asked him a question about one philosophical point. He looked at me and he said, I've taught that before and you've heard it, but you haven't remembered. And I kind of went, gulp, okay. The thing is that the full ordination for women exists still in Chinese Buddhism. And in Southeast Asia, in the Theravada tradition, they're beginning to reinstate it. There's a lot of opposition, but there's also been success. In the Tibetan tradition, there's a lot of opposition. I think it's similar to in Catholicism, where you say, you know, at the time of Jesus, at the time of Buddha, it was done like this, And in the case of Buddhism, you know, there were fully ordained nuns at the time of the Buddha, but there were conditions for transmitting the ordination, and those conditions no longer exist. So the monks say, well, sorry, you can't fully ordain. And we try and say, well, actually, the Buddha's purpose in making those conditions was to help women ordain, not to prevent them from ordaining. But, you know, I mean, you're very aware that it takes time to change people's minds. And I think the real reasons are fear, you know. It's been without women in prominent positions for millennia. Why change things? You know, if women have, you know, equal possibility, then, you know, there might be competition, and who knows what will happen. And so I think in many ways there's a lot of unconscious fear. And so it's led me to believe that many times people first decide what they believe, and then they find scripture to back up what they believe. Because I think if you believe something else, because other people have looked in the Buddhist scriptures, and they have found reasons why the ordination could be given. I myself and a few other Western nuns, we have gone to Taiwan and received the full ordination in the Chinese tradition. So, you know, we've gone ahead, we've gone outside our own tradition to receive it. But what's interesting is my teachers, including the Dalai Lama, they all accept it, you know, and they say that's fine, and we just do our practice and mind our own business and don't make a big fuss about it. You assume all these precepts, so the ordination means you adopt the precepts, you know, you wear the robes, you shave your head, you know, and then you take part of the responsibility for maintaining the teachings through your study, through your practice, and then also passing the teachings on to other people so that, you know, the teachings can endure over many generations. Not everybody becomes teachers or preachers. We usually say teachers. We don't like preaching very much. But not everybody does that. But the idea is that even through your practice and your service to the monastery, you show an example of somebody who's living in ethical discipline, somebody who's cultivating forgiveness, love, compassion, wisdom, kindness. And so that acts as something inspiring to others. Oh, it's wonderful. The people I deal with teach me so much. Because what's amazing is some of the men, I deal mostly with men. We have a few women, but mostly it's men who contact us. And, you know, they've done some of the things that I am most afraid of. And yet when they write to me and ask for advice, you know, I mean, one of my precepts is when somebody asks for spiritual help, I must give it. And so there was no choice. I just gave it. And that's how I got involved in prison work. It wasn't my decision to go out and do it. It's like people came to me and I responded and I really began to love it. And so I've realized that people are not one action in their life. And that generalizing who somebody is, calling them even a prisoner or calling them a criminal, that makes it sound like that's the sum of their entire life. And it's not. You know, it's one act they did. And, you know, we criticize, we can say the act is horrible or inappropriate or unsuitable or whatever you want to call it. But that doesn't mean the person is evil. And it doesn't mean the person is irredeemable or anything like that. Because these people are writing and they're saying, you know, I realize that I need to change. Will you help me change? Well, it's not only meditation, it's also hearing the teachings. you know, both things together. Okay, well, I can give you a couple of interesting examples. One is one man who was, I guess, a very wealthy drug dealer in Southern California. He had several cars and a lot of money. And eventually he got busted when he was in his, I think, 20s, maybe early 30s. And they gave him a 20-year prison sentence. And it shocked him, you know, kind of that long being in prison. And then when he started learning about Buddhism, we talk a lot about cause and effect, you know, how our actions have an ethical dimension that bring effects in our life. And so he started looking at all the choices and decisions he made in his life, which were causes that brought on different effects that in those situations, then again, he made more decisions which became causes for more effects. And he really began to see that since the time when he was quite young, he made some very, very bad decisions. And that one bad decision led to the next one, and he wound up with a 20-year sentence. And so it really made him start looking at what were his motivations, what are his intentions. When he gets out of prison, what kind of human being does he want to be? What kind of thoughts does he want to have motivate his actions? And so he really changed in that way. He's been out for some years and he's doing well. Yeah, I think so. I haven't been in touch with him recently. Yeah, but I think so. There's another man who, he raped somebody and was in for a number of years. And again, you know, had to do this whole life review about, you know, what were all the conditions in his life that made him do that. And, you know, we worked through a lot of things and, you know, he got clean in terms of not drinking and drugging and, you know, and his parents were very, very kind to him. I don't think he could have been as successful after he got out if it weren't for his parents' help as well. Anyway, he lived in across the country and, you know, he really got very deeply involved in Buddhism and now he lives close to the Abbey. He comes up and offers service and attends our retreats and our teachings a lot. And, you know, he's been doing just fantastic. In terms of his own mind, what is very difficult for him is there are all these laws about having to register as a sex offender. So it's very difficult for him to get a job. And he wants to work and he wants to use his brain doing work. And it's extremely difficult to get employment. And for many, many people who come out of prison, the stigma of, you know, having a sentence really makes it difficult for them to, again, earn a living and be useful members of society. So it's almost as if our laws are setting up a condition for the perfect condition for people to reoffend and wind up back in prison. Because they get out, they have no money. You know, the prison gives them $40. They're supposed to buy a bus ticket to where they used to live and somehow come up with a place to stay, food, and a job. How do you do that? You know? I think that monastic life and meditation do calm your mind and help you. But what I think is not correct is people thinking that all you do is take precepts and ordain and now all your problems are gone. No, you have to practice. Yeah, just shaving your head and putting on robes doesn't change your mind. Your anger, your resentment, your laziness, all of those things follow you right into the monastery and you have to deal with them. But your meditation and your study and your spiritual practice, they're what help you change all of those things. I knew within a few months that I wanted to ordain, and I was very persistent in asking my teacher. He made me wait about a year and a half, which was actually quite good. But now when I get people who come to the Abbey and they haven't been involved in Buddhism for so long and they say, I want to ordain, and you know, it's a lifelong commitment, then I'm always saying, slow down, slow down. And so I wonder if I, the person who I used to be, would show up at the Abbey, you know, what would I think? Oh, she's just pushing it, going too fast. But at the same time, because that was my own experience of knowing quite clearly early on, I do give people, you know, who have that burning desire, I do listen to them in a different way than other people do. You know, other people just say, no, 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 you have to wait. And I say, let's check up and see what's going on and, you know, see how stable the person is and all. You don't just move in and become a nun, you know, or a monk immediately. You come in and live with the five precepts for lay followers. Then they take eight precepts, and we have a blue outfit that they wear. They shave their head, wear the blue outfit, and keep the eight precepts for about a year. And this is really a time of exploration for them to see if taking the precepts is really going to work for them, and if it's a time for the community to check out, you know, how they fit in our community, a time for them to check out the monastic lifestyle. And then after that, they, you know, if they want to proceed, then they can request to take the novice precepts. They keep those for 2 years. Then they can request full ordination. Yeah, even with the novice, we say somebody ordains as a novice. We use the word in that way too. We say that people who have the novice, how we use the word novice, the novice ordination and the full ordination, we call both of those people monastics. It's just when you're a novice, you have fewer precepts. You don't have the same responsibility, and the accepting the full ordination, the full precepts, it has a very powerful effect on your mind that changes you. And when you just have the novice ordination, you don't understand that. You know, you can't, you don't experience that until you take the full ordination. So in the Tibetan tradition, the monks will ordain novice nuns. But for the full ordination, according to scripture, you need a complement of fully ordained nuns and fully ordained monks. Since fully ordained, the full ordination for women never went to Tibet because they didn't have so many Indian fully ordained nuns who traveled over the Himalaya Mountains. It was rather difficult in the 7th century to do that. Then the full ordination never went to Tibet. So they say, well, there's no fully ordained women. You're supposed to have them to give the full ordination to the women. So, sorry, you can't give it. You can, you know, you can only have novice nuns. So I'm getting into a bit of the technicalities with theology. I didn't know if your listeners would be so interested in that, but that's what it involves. The Tibetans also often call nuns Annie or Anila, which also means auntie. And most of us were not so pleased with being called auntie. We thought, you know, it's time for people to respect women. And so women and men, at least in English-speaking language, what we use in general, not everybody does this, but we use the term venerable. But again, not everybody does that. Oh, you just take out, first you, if you have long hair, you take out the scissors, I mean, and you cut the length of your hair off. Then you take some electric clippers and you make it even shorter. And then you take usually a razor blade, you know, a razor, and, you know, make it completely smooth. And it feels good. And you don't have to worry about hair clogging your bathroom drain. I used to be a dancer, and so not dancing was difficult. Like I mentioned before, you know, thinking of, you know, having a guy's arm around me, you know, I had to really grow up emotionally and start taking care of myself emotionally instead of relying on a partner to always, you know, support me and so on. It really made me grow up. One thing I was going to say, you might want to mention the title of a couple of other books that people may want to read. One is called Working with Anger, and another one is called Open Heart, Clear Mind. And then another one that's quite popular is called Buddhism for Beginners. Sure, my pleasure. Thank you, Maureen.